live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to explore the latest on the Indian tree bark and what it does to enhance your athletic performance, University of California, and how coconut oil, just a teaspoon a day, improves memory and brain function, University of Malaya in Malaysia, where they use a lot of coconuts. And we're going to explore also the omega-3 fatty acids, especially if you have asthma, and how depression can muddle thinking, University of Milan, and a lot more on health and healing. Then we're going to have a look at some of the important issues, including part two of how false allegations of rape are being used to literally lynch, to kill Africans who are refugees and Palestinians in Israel. And the person sharing this is an Israeli journalist. And then we're going to take a look at what Dennis Kucinich, former congressman from Ohio, has to say about what's going on with the intelligence agencies. I think you'll find his segment, it's short, it's only 5 minutes long, but I think you'll find it relevant, and then I'll share my own perspective on that as well. And then the Enbridge Line Number 3 pipeline, and what are the answers, what are the questions concerning these pipelines? We'll have a segment on that as well. My guest in the second part of our program today is Michael Brownlee, and we're going to talk about the food crisis facing America, especially in light of all the people claiming we only have about 9 years before life as we know it is no longer sustainable for many people. So what are you going to eat? And what if the food's not there? Michael is a leading national pioneer in the local food movement, whose efforts in preserving food sustainability in his home state of Colorado is being recognized in other regions of the nation. And he is the publisher of Local Food Shift magazine. So we're going to talk about that, a positive way of dealing with something that we know is coming. So we have a lot to share today. Let's begin. First up, there is what is called the Indian tree bark, and it's an extract. And according to the research from the University of Southern California, it has boosted cardiovascular efficiency, helping your heart, and improves athletic performance. And that's because of its ability to increase the left ventricular ejection fraction, the measure of how much blood is being pumped out of the heart's main pumping chamber, which is the left ventricle, with each contraction. So that's good. This was published in the American Journal of Therapeutics. Quote, based upon the findings of this study, we deduce that the extract was able to increase, in this case, the fraction, without causing any cardiac injury. The study successfully demonstrates the extract's ability to enhance the performance and also protect the heart in young, exercising adults. So that's important because we want people to exercise and we want to do something that helps their heart. Now, there are other things we can use you've heard about. This is just another piece of the puzzle. Taurine helps, Q10 helps, which is ubiquinol, vitamin E, L-carnitine, turmeric, and DMG, they're all good for the heart. From the University of Malaya, which is in Malaysia, they did a study on coconut oil. And they had had a lot of empirical evidence, but they wanted to see if it was better when they did a study. And there's a lot of evidence that it reverses dementia, and which some people, by the way, actually consider diabetes 3, meaning diabetes of the brain. Because if you look at a lot of the people suffering from dementia, they have imbalances in their metabolism and their glucose levels, and that this definitely impacts the brain. So no matter how many times these studies surface, the mainstream media constantly refers to experts who insist on demanding even more studies. And it seems the medical field needs to know how something works with detailed explanations rather than relying upon the observable facts that people using coconut oil can prevent and recover a lot of their behavior suffering from dementia and other neurological issues. We've seen it. In fact, almost everyone, I'm recommending 1 teaspoon to a tablespoon of coconut oil, extra virgin coconut oil, each day. So it does a lot of good. Well, a recently published Malayan coconut oil study, quote, this is in vivo in animals, quote, enhanced memory in Wistar rats by virgin coconut oil is associated with increased antioxidative and reduced oxidative stress. So in case you're wondering how rodents that don't read or write or respond to visual cues or of symbols can be tested for cognitive capacity or memory, is done with the Morris water maze. But this particular research activity went beyond observing the ability to learn and remember what they had learned. The researchers wanted those biochemical details and the mechanics of their activities to understand just how virgin olive oil enhances memories. And so there was a double-blind study, and it worked. So it took about 30 days. So just imagine how your body could benefit, your brain could benefit with 1 teaspoon a day of coconut oil. And by the way, one of the ways we know it works is coconut oil and its medium-chain fatty acids protect against amyloid beta, induced neurotoxicity, and in the neurons, the cortical neurons. And amyloid beta is a protein fragment, precursor, to amyloid plaque and brain tangles that manifest dementia. So coconut oil also stimulated AKT protein enzyme pathways, which play a role in multiple cellular processes, such as glucose metabolism, so it's good for diabetics, the programmed cell death, so it's good for people with cancer, cell proliferation and transcription and cell migration. So on all levels, that organic coconut oil is really good for you. There's also an article in the Journal of Clinical Investigation, and it explains the role of the omega-3 fatty acids as specialized mediators in asthma and reveals how the fatty acids are working and helping to impact the condition. So that's important too. And then from the University of Milan, which is in Italy, they did a research project on depression. Now we know that depression is associated with sadness and fatigue and lack of purpose in life, giving up, lack of motivation. But people with depression can also have trouble processing information and solving problems. Now scientists studying a model for depression are identifying on a molecular level how the condition could affect thinking. The findings are published in the journal ACS, Chemical Neuroscience, and could lead to the development of new depression treatments. And by the way, there are a lot of people who are depressed, about 350 million worldwide, all ages. And among the mix of symptoms that characterize the condition are cognitive dysfunctions and difficulty concentrating and remembering details and making decisions. And these symptoms tend to linger even as other symptoms fade, which can seriously hamper a person's ability to work or study. And the researchers found that certain proteins were expressed in higher amounts in the control group in response to a standard cognitive test. So what does this mean? It means that when we are stressed, any kind of stress, it disrupts normal hormones and it becomes pro-inflammatory, which in itself can contribute to depression. when we're having a faulty diet, when we don't have good probiotics in our gut, when we have unhealthy bacteria from eating sugar, drinking alcohol, having processed carbohydrates, rolls, muffins, pretzels, potato chips, when we have a lot of sugar, soft drinks, all this contributes to a unhealthy bacteria, which can also impact our brain and hence impact our depressed state. Lack of exercise, being very sedentary, not good. Sitting for more than 2 hours without standing and bending your knees and getting some blood flowing, also not good. And not being in vibrant environments. One of the things about living in New York City that I learned long ago, I was stuck in this little tiny, and I mean tiny, about 400 square foot apartment, and that is small. In fact, the bathtub that I used was actually in the middle of the kitchen, which is small itself. So on the one hand, when a buddy of mine came up from Parkersburg to visit me and said, wow, man, this is kind of cramped, isn't it? And I said, well, yeah, but also a half a block from here is Riverside Park. And I go down there each day, and I sit around the Soldiers and Sailors Memorial. I look over the Hudson River. Now, that's a wonderful view. And you have green everywhere. And I go for running up and down the riverside. And then I can go across to Central Park. And that's where I took my daughter, Shelley, on Sundays. Go over to the Children's Zoo, the Delacorte Theater Zoo area. And so get out into the green. And so even if you live in not the best environment, you can certainly find beautiful places in your environment. And just being in those beautiful places, sitting in a botanical garden, sitting overlooking a river. And almost every community in America now recognizes the importance of green spaces. So take advantage of them. It helps your health and helps ease depression. And also, just breathing in two spices can keep you 25% more alert. Now, that's kind of neat when you consider how powerful this is. And this was done at the Wheeling Jesuit University and the research. And it increased alertness, decreased levels of frustration and anxiety and fatigue. And what are the two scents that do this? Peppermint and cinnamon. Merely smelling cinnamon or peppermint can improve performance, several types of memory tasks, and like many spices, both cinnamon and peppermint have antioxidant, anti-inflammatory properties. So they could help you on many different levels. And cinnamon is one of the most important antioxidants in the world. And regular consumption can lower your blood sugar, help digestion, ease arthritis, lower your blood pressure, even help prevent Alzheimer's and Parkinson's along with other things. So it's got one of the highest ORAC, which stands for oxygen radical absorbance capacity, of any product in the world. In fact, cinnamon comes in third, only lower than clove and sumac. And clove oil is a great thing to smell as well. And peppermint is a perfect spice for brainstorming. It's an energy booster. The scent invigorates the mind and promotes concentration and stimulates clear thinking. So just take two drops of peppermint oil and just put it on your collar. You won't see it, but it's linked to greater cognitive stamina, motivation, and overall performance. And you're going to smell it for at least 2 to 3 hours. And what happens is the smell of peppermint is known to improve our cognitive memory. And when administered either through the mouth or the nose, the smell can improve our recognition and our working memory and our overall response. In fact, there was a study published in the Journal of International Society of Sports found when participants drank peppermint-infused water for 10 days, it improved their pain threshold. So use the essential oils, and especially the Sense of Smell Institute did a study and found that cinnamon was really up there as far as helping with your brain, and peppermint in that improving quality of life. Something that simple that easy, and it's right in front of us. And you can get these essential oils any place, online, and just get the pure oils. And at night, if you're having trouble going to sleep, you can put 3 drops of lavender oil on your pillow. And you'll be breathing it in, and it'll just work you into a very relaxing place. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment.
I've heard people say that too much of anything is not good for you, baby. But I don't know about that. As many times as we've loved and we've shared love and made love, it doesn't seem to me like it's enough.
Nice to have you with us today. Let's go over now and hear what Dennis Kucinich had to say about the White House being under attack from elements inside the intelligence community. Whether you're for or against Trump is irrelevant. The idea that, from my perspective, that the CIA, which represents the deep state, was able to manipulate information and get it out. And keep this in mind when he's saying this. Just remember, during the Obama administration, Obama went after more whistleblowers and imprisoned them than all other presidents in American history combined. Now think of that for a moment. People who sacrificed their freedom to inform us that there were illegal activities going on in federal agencies, they were prosecuted for informing us, and not a single perpetrator of the crimes they were informing on was held accountable by the media or by the government. That's the power of the deep state.
Retired General Keith Kellogg is now National Security Acting Advisor. Kellogg, along with retired General David Petraeus and Robert Harwood, a former deputy commander of U.S. Central Command, reportedly potential replacements for the position. Joining us right now is former Democratic presidential candidate, former Ohio congressman and Fox News contributor Dennis Kucinich. Congressman, good to see you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning.
So the Department of Justice had reportedly warned the Trump administration that Flynn could be vulnerable to blackmail for his connection to the Russian ambassador. Are you surprised by the resignation? What's your take here?
Well, General Flynn has admitted misleading the vice president. But I think we have to look at this a little bit deeper. A phone call from the incoming director of national security was intercepted, and the contents given to the media, and you have to so obviously shared by intelligence officials. Now, what's at the core of this is an effort by some in the intelligence community to upend any positive relationship between the U.S. and Russia. And I tell you, there's a marching band and chowder society out there. There's gold in them there hills. There are people trying to separate the U.S. and Russia so that this military-industrial intel axis can cash in.
So is the bigger issue here, in your view, the fact that this was leaked and somebody inside the White House got this news out to the press? What are you saying?
Well, look, it's an issue, and the general has admitted in his resignation letter that he misled the vice president. That's a bad thing. But the American people have to know that there's a game going on inside the intelligence community where there are those who want to separate the U.S. from Russia in a way that would reignite the Cold War. That's what's at the bottom of all this. It's like it's early in the morning, it's Valentine's Day, but wake up, America.
Wow.
Congressman, do you think that this fundamentally changes the prospect of a stronger relationship with Russia, or do you think that things can proceed as they have been proceeding, as the president has said he'd like to proceed?
Hey, look, this what's going on in the intelligence community with this new president is unprecedented. They're making every effort to upend him. Who knows what the truth is anymore? This is like the electronic version of Mad Magazine, spy versus spy. And so the bottom line is, we should not start a Cold War again with Russia. The American people forked over billions of dollars for the last one and changed the quality of life in this country. There's something wrong going on here in the intelligence community.
So what should Donald Trump do then?
Well, look, first of all, he has to get a hold of of his own intelligence apparatus. You know, this isn't a joke. This is a serious matter. If he doesn't get control of where the information's coming from, he'll never know the truth. The American people won't know the truth. And we could be set at war with almost any country.
Almost any country? No. China, Iran, and Russia? Yes. Would we win those wars? Not humanly possible. Would millions upon hundreds of millions of people lose their lives? Yes. Would it bankrupt America? Yes. That's the power of the military-industrial complex. That's the power of the deep state. But I want to share some insights with you now that are more specific. What we know is that the deep state controls all the power players. They select them, they reward them, but then you're there to serve the interests of the deep state. Now, another name for the deep state is a state within a state. It is a political situation in a country where an organism or a faction or a segment of the system does not choose to respond to any political leadership. No scrutiny, no control system. In the majority of cases, this internal group functions behind the government, but controls every aspect of the government, which can also have elements outside the legislature and judicial system. It has its own agenda. Now, whether that agenda is to make sure that everyone working for it is given permanent job security and enhanced power and authority and ideological missions that they can be excited being a part of. Let me give you an example. If you or I fail at a business, then we've lost our income, we've lost our savings, we put ourselves in harm's way financially. Think for a moment. Think of all the false flag operations, think of all the misadventures, think of all the illegal activities of the deep state. Name me one time any of them suffered consequences. Even when they are known to have lied, when Clapper lied before Congress and he was called out on it, was there anyone who came forward and said, let's bring him up on charges of perjury? No. So we have caught them lying repeatedly. Name the single person from the FBI or the CIA or Homeland Security who went to jail because they engaged in illegal activities. Not one in their history. Not Shackley. None of the people who were the masterminds behind this and part of the deep state. Now, how many people who exposed the crimes were punished, reputations ruined, or they went to jail? Dozens. So the people focus upon the source of the information and condemn it, like an Edward Snowden or Bradley Manning or Chelsea Manning. But they don't go after what exactly did they expose? How does that impact people? Why aren't those people held accountable? Because the deep state controls the media. In fact, at one time, it actually was on the record by the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency under the Church Committee, where he stated, yeah, we have all these operatives. And then I played a clip on this program of the news director at CBS talking about, yeah, we have all these. And they had 1,400 people at one time, the CIA, within the media. So any media you went to break a story, there was a high possibility that you would come into contact with one of their agents who could then subordinate that story, spike it, or downplay it. Why do you think that all the television media advertised drugs whose side effect is death? When was the last time you saw an ad, let's say on television, for an allergy? So you have an allergy, you take this drug, and it says that you can die. Or a sleepless night, and you die. Or let's say it's you're feeling in a blue mood and you take a product and you die. When did you hear any of the hosts saying, you know, there are natural non-toxic ways of dealing with insomnia or allergies and or mood swings? Never. That's the deep state. That's the control they have. So if they're controlling everything at every level and you're not aware of that, you're not aware that they control every internal organ of government. And then I'll just share some historical examples. the Catholic Church operated with European national governments, particularly in Italy. In fact, the government was subordinated to the papacy. So whatever the politics was of the Pope, every one of those governmental agencies better fall in line, including the media. That's just one tiny example. The Ottoman Empire and post-Ottoman modern Turkey was notorious for deep state operations within government that obfuscated popular policies. For example, the Caracal Society or the Young Turks, and later the Grey Wolves or the Gulen movement. Those are all deep state movements. In 2014, Princeton and Northwestern universities published an extensive study looking at 1,800 federal legislative policies covering the Reagan through the Bush administrations and ranked them according to whether they favored the upper 10% or the bottom 80%. The vast majority favored the bottom 10%. That's our one percenters. I've always said there's not 1%, there's 10 to 20%. And mainly large businesses and banking interest, even when popular opinion opposed them, didn't matter. In an interview with MIT Technology Review, one of the study's authors stated, "Ordinary citizens have virtually no influence over what their government does in the United States. An economic elite and interest groups, especially those representing business, have a substantial degree of influence." Now, he calls this economic elite domination and concludes the U.S. is a full-fledged oligarchy and no longer a democracy. Now, an oligarchy is only half an equation. Those are individuals, the system that they work through that protects their position of power. Then that is a totalitarian regime which uses fascism, the combination of working with government and private interest, the public-private cooperative together, and then they protect their interest from dissidents, from anyone taking power or changing their power structure by a police state, and hence fascism. So here's where you combine totalitarianism by a small group of elite oligarchs into a system that is fascism and manifested as a police state. The study also showed that although Democrats have been historically supportive of the needs of the poor and the middle class, their relationship is not that anymore. And the study also supports what Dennis Kucinich just said. And also, we have a class war, and the class has lost. And by the way, at a certain point, the overdrive to dislodge Trump and his administration from power, in effect to indict him or throw him out of office, you better be aware of this, and I'm going to give you a heads up. I travel a great deal. I spend a lot of time listening to what people have to say. You've got 60 million people plus who believe that their lives could be made better by this man. Now, I've shared what I believe this man's limitations are and why he will not be able to deliver on that, even if he wanted to. But I also know that, set him aside, he's merely a symbol. He surrounded himself with people even worse than him. And now, when you put all that together, he is going to fail, but the attacks against him are going to cause a civil war in the United States. Now, it will not be based upon color. It'll be based upon class. Do you really want to see what it's like to have 60 million people feeling that you destroyed any hope for a future and change? Because you know who they're going to blame. And that's just a step away from where we're at right now. Let me give you examples of how the deep state, this hidden government, actually works. I'll talk about the Obama deep state. Obama promoted TARP, and that was merely to help the big banks. But the public was against it. In fact, 77% of the public disapproved of TARP. The deep state wanted it. They got it. Obama promised he would help people. He helped not a single person. But he did help all the banks. The deep state, each of the last four presidents, pursued a total deregulatory agenda as part of financial reform. They wanted the banking industry to have no limitations. The public demanded regulations to protect the public from corporate greed and abuse. Deep state won. Obama's deep state ran supporting unions in order to get their vote. And because unions have been declining in membership, the public demanded that, and yet Obama then worked against all the unions. All of his policies were anti-union. Trans-Pacific Partnership totally would have destroyed all unions in the United States. Obama was told to repeal Citizens United. Instead, he kept the elite in positions of influence and never did anything against Citizens United. Yet the majority of Americans want Citizens United repealed. Obama continued our military and foreign policies of aggression in the Middle East, including in Libya and Syria, Afghanistan and Iraq and Yemen and Somalia. And yet the public, the vast majority of the public, wanted us to get out of the Middle East. Obama's deep state gave everything to private contractors, hundreds of billions of dollars just in surveillance alone to make sure that every American, every single day, every single thing they did was monitored and filed, kept on record. The public demanded topple the surveillance and spying activities on Americans, stop it. The deep state won. Obama pushed for genetically modified foods. The American public, by almost 90%, says we don't want GMOs. We want it labeled. The deep state won. Obama's deep state, all administrations favor big oil, and they were really slow on anything like renewables. For example, what policies did Obama enact on geothermal, even though we have a huge amount of geothermal springs in the United States? Nothing. How about wave power? Nothing. How about the new style of wind power without all the tall blades? Nothing. And the only time they did anything with solar was to a company that gave huge financial donations and was politically connected to people around Obama. The deep state won because the majority of Americans want renewable and get rid of fossil fuels. The deep state promised minimum wage. Obama did nothing. In fact, everything benefited big firms and the elite. The public, the large majority, supported an increased minimum wage. Obama's deep state ran on universal health care. Remember that? He's going to give us universal health care? No, he gave us Obamacare so the medical and insurance industries could boom. The medical and insurance industries are controlled by the deep state. The American public wanted a single-payer expansion of Medicare for all, so no human being would ever have to lay out a dollar out of their own pocket for co-pays or anything else. You could save $1 trillion by getting rid of the insurance industries and take the profit out of medicine. The deep state won. The deep state controls the media. Deep state controls the national security agencies and filters the news and commentaries to meet its need. The public wants a free press, and yet there isn't one. Also, look at the deep state, the coup in the Ukraine. Who did it benefit? Cargill, Monsanto, Wall Street investment banks, and big oil. The Libyan regime change. Who did it benefit? Big oil and preserve the U.S. hegemony of the petrodollar and U.S. financial interests in Africa. No action on Israel, war crimes in Gaza, in violation of international laws. It benefited the Israeli Zionist lobby who controlled Obama and Israel's private intelligence agencies and technologies and Israel's exports. Didn't help the average American at all. And it hurt the Palestinians. Look at the deep state's war in Somalia, Yemen, Syria. And by the way, the war against ISIS is non-existent by the United States. But hundreds of billions of dollars can be spent by private military contractors and Wall Street investors benefit, all because the CIA and the Defense Department control the war against ISIS and have allowed ISIS to get weapons and to get funding and training. And we work cooperatively with Turkey and Saudi Arabia, Qatar and United Arab Emirates, all of whom support ISIS, al-Nusra, Al-Qaeda. So it's a game. Obama's sanctions and aggressions toward Russia benefit the ongoing military-industrial complex and numerous private corporate interests who want greater access to Russia's economy and resources. So you say, well, Gary, there is no such thing as a real deep state. Oh, yeah, there is. Well, is it new? Well, this is a letter from Thomas Jefferson to John Taylor in 1816. Quote, I sincerely believe with you that banking establishments are more dangerous than standing armies. From President John Calhoun, by the way, he was our seventh president from 1825 to 1832. The power has risen up in the government greater than the people themselves, consisting of many and various and powerful interests combined into one mass and held together by a cohesive power of a vast surplus in the banks. John Hyland, he was the mayor of New York City, 1918 to 1925. The real menace of our republic is the invisible government, which like a giant octopus sprawls its slimy legs over our city, states, and nation. The little coterie of powerful international bankers virtually run the United States government for their own selfish purposes. They practically control both parties and control the majority of the newspapers and magazines in this country. They use the columns of these papers to club into submission or drive out of office public officials who refuse to do the bidding of the powerful corrupt cliques which compose the invisible government. It operates under the cover of self-created screen and seizes our executive officers, legislative bodies, schools, courts, newspapers, and every agency created for the public protection. Teddy Roosevelt. Behind the ostensible government sits enthroned an invisible government, owing no allegiance and acknowledging no responsibility to the people. To destroy this invisible government, to befoul the unholy alliance between corrupt business and corrupt politics, is the first task of the statesmanship of the day. Now, here's something interesting. This is Edward Bernay. He was the father of public relations. He wrote this before he became famous for doing what he was doing in the publication Propaganda that I found. The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. We are governed. Our minds are molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we have never heard of. Woodrow Wilson. This was from his book, The New Freedom. Since I entered politics, I have chiefly had men's views confided to me privately. Some of the biggest men in America in the field of commerce and manufacture are afraid of somebody, are afraid of something. They know that there is a powerful group, organized, so subtle, so watchful, so interlocked, so complete, so pervasive, that they had better not speak above their breath when they speak in condemnation of it. Senator William Jenner, 1954. Today, the path to total dictatorship in the United States can be laid by strictly legal means. We have a well-organized political action group in this country determined to destroy our Constitution and establish a one-party state. It operates secretly, silently, continuously to transform our government. This ruthless, power-seeking elite is a disease of our century. This group, unanswerable neither to the president, the Congress, nor the courts, is practically irremovable. Dwight Eisenhower. January 17, 1960, in his farewell address. This conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, our resources, livelihoods are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of governments, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for disastrous rise of misplaced power exists, and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals so that our security and liberty may prosper together. President John F. Kennedy, April 27, 1961. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of election, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned. No rumor is printed. No secret is revealed. And finally, Senator Frank Church, 1975. I know the capacity that there is to make tyranny total in America, and we must see to it that this agency, the National Security Agency, and all agencies that possess this technology operate within the law and under proper supervision so that we never cross over that abyss. That is the abyss from which there is no return. Well, I have many more statements, but we have passed long ago over the abyss, and they are in complete control. They even have, for a period of time, controlled all the major non-commercial media as well at different levels. They have not controlled all the individual voices, all the individual producers, and all the individual volunteers. There are many who still will not be intimidated, not be co-opted, not be bought, but they are in the minority today. The rest are either ignorant of this silent government, this deep state, but it exists, and you're seeing it play out now. I'm Gary Nall. Let's go to my guest, who is standing by. I gave you his background and introduction earlier in the program. He is over in Denver, Colorado. Michael Brownlee, nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for having me on today.
Michael, we're going to talk about the food crisis facing America and the urgent need for a mobilization of a local food revolution. And I see that you're somewhat aligned with climate change experts such as Tim Garrett at the University of Utah and Guy McPherson and Paul Beckwith and others. I'd like for you to comment on the actual state of America's food security right now, and particularly with respect to global warming and changes in extreme weather associated with climate change. And what do you see as the weakest links in our entire national food security model? And keep in mind that I'm asking you this at a time when 99% of Americans have no idea that there are food crises, that we may have food crises and will have food crises in the United States, that many states are either so flooded that seeds are rotting or so hot that feeds will not fully germinate and grow into plants. Because every day they go to open a refrigerator, it's filled with as much food as they choose. Every store is loaded to the top, and they're disconnected from those parts of the world that are suffering. That is the perspective I'd like for you to share with us.
Sure. Happy to talk about this. It's absolutely true, as you say, Gary, that most people are unaware of the predicament that we face around food. And, you know, our organization has been working kind of at the front lines of the local food movement for more than a decade now. And what we can say about that is that the local food movement is essentially stalled, much like the environmental movement is. So that means that in this country, almost everywhere, only 1 to 2% of all the food that we eat is local. All the rest of the food that we eat is from the global industrial food system, which controls, you know, about 98, 99% of our food supply at this time. So we have become very dependent on this industrialized food system, which we are now learning is killing us, really. Of all the people who die in this country every year, a little bit more than half of them die from food-related illnesses. I mean, this is a direct result of the industrial food system. What's worse is that this global industrial food system is the largest contributor to global warming. If you look at all of food and agriculture end-to-end globally, it's contributing more than 51% of all greenhouse gas emissions. So that means that this industrial food system is actually the primary cause of the sixth mass extinction of species that's happening on the planet today that threatens even the human species. And what most people cannot see, because we've taken this industrial food system for granted for so long, you know, mostly since World War II, that it's become invisible to us, it's become unconscious. But this industrial food system itself is in danger of collapse. And we know this from the few scientists who are paying attention to the impact of global warming on food production capacity. So one of the scientists that we've been paying attention to is Dr. David Battisti, who is the chair of the Atmospheric Sciences Department at the University of Washington. And just about a year ago, down at a big climate conference in Tucson, he revealed his data, his analysis, and it's pretty shocking when you look at it. He said if you just use the UN's IPCC projections, which, as we know, are very conservative, out of date, and don't take into account many of the feedback loops that people like Guy McPherson have been educating us about. He said, but if you just take their numbers as a baseline, we're looking at a 30 to 40% reduction in food production capacity globally by the end of the century. But that doesn't take into account things like related stuff, like the increased pest pressure, the disease transmission, which, you know, together could add an additional 30% reduction. Doesn't take into account the violent weather, the droughts and water shortages we're going to see. And maybe most importantly, it doesn't take into account the loss of land that we're seeing these days, much of it due to soil erosion, to desertification, and even sea level rise. So if you add all of this up, it looks like we could see a reduction in global food production by 50 or 60% over the next 30 years. The next 30 years. I mean, it is a global disaster that is unfolding before our eyes, and no one's talking about it. No one's planning for it. And it requires a response. So even the industrial food system that most people have come to depend upon will collapse, you know, in a fairly short period of time. So that means that the only way that we can respond to this crisis is to build highly localized, very resilient regional food systems that are totally independent of this industrial food system, which has been created by what we call the unholy alliance of big ag and big food and big pharma, all supported by big banking and big government and big oil. So that unholy alliance altogether now comprises the largest industry in the world, and it's gone invisible. So
Mike,
we don't,
Mike,
yeah, sure.
Michael, recently I did a commentary on this program about the increase in food riots happening in many underdeveloped countries and few developed countries around the world. And these have been mostly short, inflammatory popular uprisings and protests due to rising food costs rather than food scarcity. And in many cases, the food is there or available, but nobody can afford it if you're an average person. And what is also underlying these riots, which is mostly ignored, is the impact of climate change and global warming that you're just referring to on food harvests and security. And also growing populations, more mouths to feed. We're not understanding this today, but in the United States, as you have observed and commented upon, access to high-quality food and produce is part of the lifestyle of the privileged. The average American cannot shop at the way the wealthy can, so there's this economic factor, but there's also the climate change and fossil fuel threats because our nation's agriculture depends so heavily upon industrial agriculture, and the agricultural model supporting and subsidized by the federal government is simply unsustainable for the future. So I'd like you to take your time and tie these various threads together. Industrial agriculture, climate change that you mentioned, food costs, massive transportation, costs of moving food, to present the case that our current agricultural paradigm that you said is could be that we could be without food, and that's conservative, for 50% of the world's population. We already right now have 1.5 billion people who are food insecure. We have 16.8 million hungry children in the United States each day. Every 24 hours, more people, more children go to bed hungry than the entire residents of New York State. So when I travel around, and I was in Colorado just a couple months ago, when I see Colorado that is in a severe drought state, irrespective of what happens with one winter, you know, snow, and I'm looking at Kansas and Indiana and Illinois, our breadbasket states, I'm looking at the Ogallala water system, the largest in America, that is going dry. It's 50% down. I'm looking at Texas, California, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah that are running dry. Georgia is running dry. Most of Florida is running dry. Alabama is running dry. And they're not even counting that in any of their figures. I've looked at where their calculations are. And when you don't even include places in the United States that historically have provided food for people but are highly densely populated, then you have a disaster waiting to happen. Your thoughts?
Well, it is a disaster waiting to happen. And, you know, our problem as a people is we're pretty good at responding to disasters when we can see them. But we're talking about a disaster that is still largely invisible to people. It's still over the horizon, so people have not gotten mobilized yet. So we think that there's a lot of work that needs to be done in the area of educating people about this. Oh, there's so much to talk about here, Gary.
What are you doing that could help us now for those in this audience who would like to know how to do local sustainable agriculture? What can they do?
So what we have decided to do is to focus on those individuals, a very small number of individuals so far, who are awakening to these issues and feeling called to play some role in all of this. We think of those people as food shed catalysts that have the internal capacity to be able to see what's needed and what's possible in their own communities. So we are actually, after we published our book called The Local Food Revolution, How Humanity Will Feed Itself in Uncertain Times, we created an online course called Igniting the Local Food Revolution in Your Community. So we're essentially raising up a cadre of well-informed, highly trained regional food shed catalysts who can play an essential role in all of this. And it's going to take a little time, but with some of the other things that we're doing, for instance, we're in June launching an online local food summit, which can attract many thousands of people and get them involved in this process of being trained for working on the ground to do this. We're talking about a radical expansion in effectiveness, in impact and scale of the local food movement. And that's what we mean by a local food revolution. And it's too much to explain the process of localizing a food supply, you know, in the space of time on a radio show.
Michael, what we're going to do is we're going to invite you back for a full hour on our Progressive Commentary Hour coming up in a couple of weeks, so you can take your time and roll all those ideas out to us. All right?
Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah.
You're doing good work out there, Michael, in Denver. We appreciate it, and I look forward to that hour coming up, so
okay,
we can
great.
show people how to create local food movements. And I'm going to also at that time, when we do that show, I'll talk about some of the efforts I'm making to help in the worst cities in America to create an urban renewal garden, to tear down some old buildings that have been abandoned and are destitute, and then put whole blocks of community gardens, organic, hydroponics, et cetera, so that people in inner cities, in the urban environment, can both support locally grown food for themselves and their neighbors. Michael Brownlee, thank you for being with us today. And Michael is the author of The Local Food Revolution. And his email address is localfoodshift.pub. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.